Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentant votre hôte, David Morrison d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Heather DiPenta is the values and ethics guru here at Global Affairs Canada. She joined GAC in the spring of 2017 after nearly 20 years in the private sector and at a series of other government departments. We chatted recently about values and ethics, the issues around harassment, including sexual harassment, and what needs to change here at Global Affairs Canada. Hi, Heather. Thanks for coming to the GAC Files today. You've told me you were all up all night studying, so
fretting somewhat.
We're not really that tough. Heather DiPenta is the Global Affairs Canada Values and Ethics Guru, and I do want to devote the bulk of our time today to getting your thoughts on where we are at Global Affairs in terms of the expected behaviors, ethical behaviors, and our efforts to have a values-driven culture. And I want to spend some time on harassment, which is something that is of great concern to the clerk and to senior management across the public service. But before then, I want to find out a little bit more about Heather DiPenta. So tell us where you're from and a little bit about your journey from there to here.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very honored to be here and to be able to talk about these topics because they're very important to me both professionally and personally. I grew up on Quebec side in Elmer, so I've been within this region my entire life. And I grew up in a household where both my parents were teachers, my mom an elementary school teacher and my dad a high school geography teacher. Mm-hmm. So every school I went to, I had a parent that was in the school. So from a values and ethics perspective, I had to be very careful.
I was sharing with Heather just before we went live that in thinking of this conversation this morning, I was going to ask her whether she always followed the rules in elementary school, and she's confessed to having only a single detention in her entire public school career.
Yes, that my parents are aware of. No, that I only did have one, and it was haphazardly for passing a note in class. And the whole class got scooped up and sent to detention, and my dad walked past the room and looked in the window and saw his daughter in there.
if that were the standard applied to the executive committee at Global Affairs, we would all be in detention all the time. There's a lot of passing of notes during long meetings. Born and raised here, but your name wasn't DiPenta.
No, it was MacLeod, very Scottish name, Heather Ann MacLeod. I married my husband, who's Italian and first generation Canadian. And his dad came over to Canada with the suit he had on and $100 in his pocket. Mm.
When?
And that was it. I'm not too sure. 60s, but I can't remember the exact date. Then his parents met here in Canada, and sort of the rest is history from there. But it has allowed me to get an opening into different cultures and really great food as well, which is fantastic.
A little better than Scottish fare, I think.
Yes, yes. And a huge wedding on top of it.
So unlike most guests so far on the GAC Files, you have not been with Global Affairs very long. You joined in April of 2017, so a year and some ago, after spending the first part of your career in various other parts of the public service. Tell us the kinds of why you joined the public service in the first place, the kinds of jobs you've had, and how that led you into your current role and previous roles dealing with conflict resolution, and now the sort of prior step of the prevention side of conflicts, which is one way to think of values and ethics.
Well, I think I kind of stumbled into the public service, really. I began in the private sector. I've done a multitude of different roles. I mean, my background is exercise physiology, which I'm sure you'll think is perfect for values and ethics. It makes perfect sense. But it just allowed me to take on a variety of roles within the public service as an ergonomist, a vocational rehabilitation specialist. I did a lot of time, most of my career is in health and safety, actually. And, you know, along the way, I've done some accommodation work and so on. So a lot of the work and experience I've had is in working through workplace issues of various different sorts, whether it's trying to return someone to work and find alternate work for them if they've got a permanent partial disability, as an example. And I think back to my days at Canada Post, if you can no longer be a letter carrier, then what do you do? What's the next step? And that was my role, to help the employee and management figure that out. So situations that are difficult, are emotional, and, you know, in some cases are a conflict just because of the situation itself, in that there might be various different sides to the story. So that has interested me to really look and explore, informal conflict management and also the employee assistance program services, to try to get a better understanding of what are these various different sides to the story, and can we talk it out? Can we work through the issues versus continuously going to formal processes where, quite honestly, at the end of the day, it's never really a win-win.
Et t'étais où exactement quand t'avais pour première fois un job, une position qui traitait de la résolution des conflits? C'était à Canadian Revenue Agency ou à Post-Canada?
Il y a plusieurs exemples, parce que dépendant de la situation, je pense qu'on est toujours en conversation autour d'un sujet, puis de différentes opinions en discutant ce sujet-là, par exemple. Alors, des exemples à Post-Canada, entre gestionnaire, le syndicat et un employé, autour de c'est quoi la meilleure approche pour un accommodement d'un employé, par exemple, ou à l'Agence de revenus de Canada, autour d'une situation de violence dans le milieu de travail, puis comment est-ce qu'on va gérer cette situation-là quand on voit que les faits sont vraiment autour d'un mauvaise compréhension de la situation, puis deux personnes qui prennent leur point de vue comme le seul point de vue. Alors, c'est vraiment pas savant que j'utilisais ces outils-là, mais c'était vraiment pour comment est-ce qu'on peut avoir une conversation puis être ouvert à entendre les points de vue.
So, you know, a famous American statesman used to say, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not to their own facts. And yet, it strikes me that in some of these really challenging cases, oftentimes the participants are really living in very different realities with very different fact bases in which they believe deeply. So I'd like your view on that, as well as on the degree to which some of this intersects with mental health issues. Or can intersect with mental health
issues. It absolutely can intersect with mental health issues. And it's unfortunate, because we see examples of very, as you mentioned, very difficult cases where just the experience of having gone through something. So I think of someone who has experienced harassment. And it can be of various different sorts. It could be sexual harassment or other types of harassment. And what they've experienced and what they lived is their own personal story and their own reality with respect to this. And then when they bring those issues to our attention and say, you know, I want to put a complaint forward, and they start talking about what they have gone through, it's not difficult to see the personal impact and how much it truly affects them right to the core, I would say. You know, I don't think anybody goes into a role, into a position, a job, an experience in the workplace where they say, boy, I really hope I get harassed while I'm here, you know. Everybody's goes into the job in wanting to bring the best that they can bring. And I see so many examples of that in this department of employees working well above and beyond on a daily basis because of their passion for their work. And, you know, over the last year, I've seen many examples of that as well, of, you know, longer hours or just really caring about a topic or caring about their portfolio. And then they're confronted with the situation of either a challenge with a colleague or, you know, a more difficult situation is, what do you do when you've got your direct supervisor or someone who's in a position of power starts sort of abusing that power a bit and starts, you know, saying inappropriate comments or, you know, perhaps in a stressful situation or in a moment of stress, start screaming at employees.
Right.
When you're the brunt of that, it starts to make you question, you know, is this actually happening, first of all? Why is it happening to me? What have I done? Is it my fault? Did I bring this on in some way, shape, or form? And then, you know, these things start to impact your mental health.
Yeah.
They really do. And in some cases, it could be someone that is starting with a mental health issue. They might be struggling with something personally. And then something that occurs in the workplace is just, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back.
Sure. You used the word power a second ago. And I want to come to the definition of harassment and how that is going to be changed, at least as it applies to the Canadian Public Service, and what I understand is the near future. But it has struck me, particularly since the Me Too movement has gained momentum, that much of the bad behavior that we have seen or read about, heard about, is actually embedded within asymmetrical power structures, where men, typically, not always, but men have the power and they abuse the power or the authority, and bad things happen. And it has struck me from the beginning that we at Global Affairs potentially have a particular set of issues with that as a traditionally male-dominated organization with many, many small branch offices unconnected or not directly connected to headquarters. So missions around the world, typically run by men, typically very hierarchical in an organizational sense, but also a power sense. And the higher-ups controlling access to what everybody wants, which are promotions and onward assignment opportunities and interesting work and so on. So that, to me, has seemed sort of the perfect storm of factors for inappropriate behavior. And yet we haven't actually seen an avalanche of new complaints. So do you think that is because they're not there, or because people are still very nervous about reporting, or what's your assessment as we're, you know, 6-8 months into the Me Too movement?
Well, I think, you know, initially we weren't sure what we were going to expect with, you know, an additional focus and an additional lens, not only in the media generally, but within our department and really wanting to look at this and caring about this particular topic. We haven't seen, as you said, an avalanche of sexual harassment cases come in, but we have started to get more complaints about harassment in general. And when I speak with other departments, it's a similar thing. So I think it has opened the door for people to feel, maybe this is the moment now I can come forward. Mm. I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head with respect to this particular department, in the sense that we do have a lot of executives. I believe we've got, you know, one of the largest amounts of executives.
10% of the EXs in the whole federal government is what people say. I don't know how accurate that is, but it is, because of our mission structure, we have a lot of executives.
So, I mean, that in and of itself shows that there, or demonstrates that, you know, there is a level of authority, there's a level of power. And in that sort of environment, I think the biggest thing we still continue to hear and see is this fear of reprisal.
Right.
I mean, if I do come forward and I do say something, I'm not going to get that next posting.
Right.
I'm not going to get that opportunity. And I won't necessarily know why. You know, I'll get a letter that says, well, you weren't chosen. And it'll leave me with wondering, was it that I wasn't chosen because I didn't have the right experience? Or was it that someone heard that I had put in a complaint and had brought something forward? And because of that, that's why I'm not getting the opportunity.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of fear related to that, and we hear it frequently. And unfortunately, the process in and of itself, and I'm glad actually the federal government is looking at the policy and looking at the process, because when you're putting in a harassment complaint, it's a very transparent process. So if, as an example, you know, I thought that you were harassing me, if I put in a complaint, you would be notified that I put in a complaint about
right.
you.
Right.
Now, imagine if we're in a small mission and there's a few people around the room, but other than that, you're living with that every single day. Right? So you would still see your manager every single day while a process of investigation
yeah.
was carrying on.
And
it's not easy.
Well, it's especially not easy because those processes take a very long time.
They do. And they do for a reason.
Yes.
Because we have to have, you know, due process, and we have to have the policies and structure is built so that it's fair. Because you also don't want someone coming forward with a complaint about somebody that's untrue.
Right.
So everyone gets an opportunity to have their say, and we can hear both sides of the story, because
yeah.
we need to hear both sides of the story. But it's difficult.
Well, it is difficult, and I think you've in a certain sense honed in on one of the most difficult aspects, which is a small mission. There is a provision whereby parties can be separated. That's extraordinarily difficult to do difficult to do in a small mission. But it's, you know, balancing the rights of the accuser and the rights of the respondent, as well as the fact that we, in a certain sense, still have a job to do on the ground. In my relatively short experience with these kinds of cases, which I'm now quite involved in my current position, things would be much better if they could go faster. I would say if the wheels of justice could turn a little bit more quickly, mm-hmm. that would be in everybody's interests. And I also believe that one of the reasons that people don't report is that they're not clear anything will happen if they do, right? So I've long advocated, or have been advocating, for some making public of the cases that are resolved, so that the wider population would know that, you know, a charge was, an allegation was made, it was sustained, there was a process, and the person at the end of that process was disciplined. That does happen, but for a variety of reasons, most people don't end up knowing how the story ends.
Okay. And part of that is privacy protection as well, right? We have to be careful. I mean, if you're the person who's accused of something and you know, you erred in some way, shape, or form, you know, you also have privacy rights as well. So again, it's like the due process in that everything needs a balance to it. And in terms of the cases and things that we deal with, I mean, we try to move things forward as quickly as we can. Given our global nature, that can be a challenge of trying to get hold of witnesses that have now left one location and they've moved on to another part in the world and we have to find them. You know, but those are just logistical challenges more than anything else. But we have to follow the steps of the process. I don't disagree in terms of reporting. I think we need to be reporting more. And when we meet with people or when we're doing awareness sessions, and we've been doing a lot of those, especially given we're just finishing up pre-posting cycle. And so we've been doing a lot of training. We remind people that, you know, the policy has a number of steps and things to it. So you bring allegations forward, and we have to first look at them. And there's a couple of tests that have to be passed. One is that the events have taken place within the last 12 months, within the year. And also they have to meet the definition of harassment. Right. And so sometimes, so it's a bit of a funnel effect. You know, we might get a few complaints in, but they don't proceed further than that, because it might be a disagreement over a performance appraisal, as an example, which might not meet the definition of harassment. So therefore, it doesn't move forward. But every time we consult someone who comes forward to, or someone consults us when they're meeting with someone on my team, we talk them through everything. So we say, you know, if we can deal with things informally first, again, that is absolutely ideal. And then the timeline is very quick.
We can resolve
the matter. Some files just can't go that way. And then we try to, not to discourage people, but to make sure that their eyes are open when they're going through the process. And I think there are areas of opportunity where we can improve things. And I'm looking forward to the new legislation coming as well, which will, again, have a greater emphasis on the informal processes as well. And we'll have to see if that's going to pick up the pace a little bit on some of these files.
Yeah, that's certainly the thing that I've heard the most is that it just takes too long.
Yeah, and it does.
Understanding that everybody's rights need to be balanced. Talk to us a little bit about the new legislation. And certainly one thing that I learned is that a single incident can constitute harassment. I had thought until relatively recently that the whole nature of harassment was that it needed to sort of be persistent. That is not the case under the new legislation, I understand, and maybe it wasn't even the case under the old legislation. But what should listeners know about changes in the legislation governing harassment?
Well, and that one single incident.
The draft legislation, yeah.
Yeah, the one single incident is something that has been there for some time. I think somewhat misunderstood, because it has to be a single incident that's had enough of an impact on the individual. And you can have a situation where it's had enough of an impact on an individual. The new legislation, you know, again, I think one of the key things that's coming forward is, again, that focus on informal conflict management. That's going to be really, really important. And also there's links between this new legislation and the topic of workplace violence, which right now is sitting under the Canada Labour Code Part 2. Interestingly enough, I was at the table many, many years ago when they were writing the first version of that legislation. So the two are going to be pairing up a little bit in the sense that it's explaining better to people avenues that are available to them to bring issues forward. And the definition of workplace violence will have some clarity to it, because I think that's a bit murky right now. So I'm hoping additional clarity in language, additional clarity in process as well, which will help. And one element that I think that I'm hoping the legislation is going to bring that we see as a challenge as well is, again, that full transparency in process. We have a number of employees that are coming forward to us under, you know, the Whistleblowing or Wrongdoing Act, because under that particular act, their identity is protected. And, you know, when you're bringing a file forward, especially of a sexual harassment nature, it's difficult enough admitting that it's happened. But then to know that your name is on that file and it's associated with you, it's very, very difficult for people. So we've had people coming forward saying, you know, is it wrongdoing, in fact? And so I'm hoping the legislation as well will help in that regard.
I spent many years in the UN system and on the development side. There are many parallels to how global affairs is organized in terms of having 150 or 170 branch offices with, frankly, some very bad behavior. Things got a whole lot better when we strengthened whistleblower protections. We instituted very robust anonymous reporting mechanisms and very severe penalties for retaliation on whistleblowers. Is there a move afoot in that sense or are you convinced or confident that our current whistleblower protections are strong enough?
I think they are strong enough. I think we struggle a little bit with what's the best avenue to deal with the situation. So because what comes into our office is often a long description of a number of things. Right. The manager's screaming and yelling. They are also maybe signing Section 34s that they shouldn't be. And it's just a litany of things. And then we have to sit with it and look at it and think, okay, well, what's the right approach to take with some of these things? A number of departments have been considering and looking at rules like an ombudsman, right? Which is that sort of thought process that opens the door and allows people to come forward more readily and for conversations then to happen within the department to say, okay, that's, you know, we've heard about this and we're putting an end to that right this minute, rather than waiting for a 12-month period of time for a report to say that we should end it and getting at it much more quickly. I think we're seeing more people come forward under the Act, and I think the Act does protect to a certain degree. I think it can do more, but I also think how our department adopts that Act and looks at that Act and uses it is something I've been thinking about a lot. Should there be a different mechanism or a separate mechanism for people to come forward? Already, our group is within the Inspector General's office, so that gives us a certain amount of neutrality, and I think that's perceived as such by employees as well. So it's almost ombudsman-like, but we don't have that specific clear rule where anything and everything can come to us and people can feel free, and they know this is the one door, and it's not the wrong door, it's the one door.
So at the deputy level, there have been multiple conversations on exactly this issue, because deputies and associate deputies are casting about for what's the best organizational model, and some departments or agencies do have an ombudsperson function and others don't. Even within within the group that has an ombudsman function, there are various models, from a classic alternative dispute resolution function to more of a concierge, one-stop shopping function. The clerk has, as you know, has been very engaged around these issues, the overall issue of harassment, for many, many months now, and there's a process afoot. There's been a listening process afoot and a compare and contrast process, looking at how the various bits of the federal government are dealing with this. There's an interesting model that I was made aware of recently, which is I think they called it a wellness hub. And that was, it had ombudsperson or ombudsman functions built into it, but it also had the wider suite of wellness initiatives, so that anybody that believed themselves to be the victim of harassment or wanting advice, everybody knew who to call. anyhow, I think this will see, I think the clerk's work will see the light of day in the coming period, and then all departments will have some recommendations and advice for how to strengthen their own systems.
Well, and I think that's great because I think, as you said, there's all kinds of experience out there of these various different models and what has proven to be helpful and what has proven to be challenging, because all of these processes are what you would call the informal processes, right?
Right.
Of having the discussion. You know, in my opinion, no matter what process it is that we put in place, it has to be linked to the overall accountability in the department. So if it's an ombudsman or somebody that it is that we've decided, or an office, whatever the case may be, they have to have the ability to bring issues right to the top and say, this is what's going on, this is what we've heard, and as managers, you know, you need to be accountable for what's going on in your shop. And we see equal the amount of issues overseas in missions as we do at headquarters as well. So it's that ability, and this is something I've been wrestling with, is in my role specifically, because I wear various different hats due to the acts and so on, is the ability to be able to come to you as an example and say, okay, I'm seeing a number of rumblings coming from this one particular area and some very disturbing things. Managers need to know, or the senior manager in that area needs to know what's going on and needs to act now.
So, I mean, in my view, it needs to be a combination of accountability, as you've just said, but over the longer term, it has to be culture.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, that's the, because we, you can either have sort of accountability and compliance, or you can have the kind of culture where it's not just the managers, but it is everybody that calls out bad behavior and says that's
Absolutely.
Not acceptable. It strikes me that you know, we will know if we are succeeding when there are fewer uses of the protection function, because people will actually feel empowered simply to call out as a work unit or a series of colleagues somebody on inappropriate behavior. Because in the recent cases that I've become aware of, it's actually not black and white. It mm-hmm. it often falls into what I think you have termed the toxic work environment.
Mm-hmm.
I hope there are fewer instances of supervisors yelling and throwing things than one hears about in the past, because the goalposts have clearly moved. But there's still lots going on that is making people uncomfortable. And we all as a community need to come together around what is today inappropriate and appropriate behavior. And that's the cultural element that takes much longer, but which is ultimately more sustainable in whatever structure or accountabilities we put in place. Anyhow, that's how I think of these things.
Well, and I would agree with that thought process, because I think there's multiple different aspects that go into that change in culture. I think, you know, the fact that you sent a message out and the deputy sent a message out to say, related to the Me Too movement, that this is of concern and this is not something that you want to see within our global affairs environment. That is the beginning of culture change. That sets the stage to say, so an employee can say, oh, okay, you know, senior management see this as an important thing and that it's not acceptable. I don't have to live with this. I don't have to hold on to this secret. And that's the beginning of change. Now, we have to follow that up with, you know, program enhancements, which we're looking at internally in our team, new legislation coming, ways of allowing employees to have access to the services and understand what they are and know how to navigate mm-hmm. the processes and so on. So that cynicism of, is it just talk or do
right.
they actually
right.
mean it? It's when they actually mean it that the culture starts to change, right? So I think it's everything we've discussed. The aspect of people being held accountable and employees know I brought something forward and something happened, as a result of that. And all of the other pieces of it. It's a bit of a puzzle, but I think, you know, bringing all the pieces together is what's going to change that culture.
And talking about it.
And
bringing it out of whispers.
Absolutely.
To say it's okay to say it's not okay.
Exactly.
If you will. So in the spirit of continuing to talk about it, I'd like to have you back, Heather.
I'd love that.
At some point in the not too distant future, maybe after we see the final shape of the new legislation and the output of the clerk's process and the output of an exercise that I'm helping to lead in terms of this department's response to harassment and where the gaps are. We're going to come forth with some global affairs specific recommendations in the fall. So in 5 or 6 months' time, I hope you'll come back, and I hope we can report upon some progress.
Well, I would love to, and you know, it's going to take all of us working on this file and talking about it and bringing this issue forward to make real change. But I'm hopeful that it can happen, and certainly the attention that this department has been paying to this topic is a fantastic sign, and the fact that more people are coming forward is a fantastic sign. It's not great to hear more issues, but at the same time, it's good that people feel they can tell them.
That was a disguised resource ask.
No, but then I look forward to seeing how this is going to progress.
Okay.
This is great. Thank you.
Thanks for your service. Merci.
Thank you. Merci.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des dossiers d'AMC.